This week, the Bush Heritage Group celebrates a decade of conservation work in Western Australia. We'll head out into the Charlie Darwin Reserve to see what's there, and we'll meet a couple of botanical artists recording the same plants collected on the ill-fated Burke and Wills expedition. We'll dust off the whites as the cricket season starts and go behind the scenes in the horse pavilion where owners are preparing their animals for the hack competition.
It's like a model competition, I suppose. The horses have to look good, be very well behaved and be able to show off in the ring. So it's a combined thing where they're good types, conformation, they work well and they look beautiful. It's like a model on the catwalk. They create a picture.
A beauty pageant for horses coming up, but let's start in the west where the Bush Heritage Group has reached a milestone.
In this woodland we can hear grey shrike thrush calling a little away from us, and right up in the canopy we've got two or three striated pardalotes that are up there feeding on insects around the canopy.
When the conservation group Bush Heritage took over White Wells Sheep Station in Western Australia's northern wheatbelt a decade ago, it was covered in weeds and teeming with feral goats, cats and foxes. But with lots of hard work, the pests are now gone, and the native flora and fauna has returned to make this area into an environmental oasis.
I can also hear a rufous whistler in the background. He's calling. They're mating at the moment and building nests, so the birds are pretty vocal around here.
Hello, I'm Olivia Garnett, and today I've joined members of the Bush Heritage team, including ecologist Angela Sanders, to celebrate 10 years of conservation here at the renamed Charles Darwin Reserve, about 350 kilometres northeast of Perth. All up, the reserve covers about 60,000 hectares, just 1% of the Avon-Meriden wheatbelt region, but it's estimated it protects between 45 to 60% of the region's birds, mammals, reptiles and frogs. That's something that Dr. Matt Appleby, another Bush Heritage ecologist, is very proud of.
The monitoring that we're doing, we're seeing that the numbers and the spread of some of the species is increasing over time, so that's really important. Species that may not have been present here as standing plants have sprung back up, and there's no sheep or goats or anything there, or rabbits, nibbling them down and reducing their numbers, so they've given a real good chance to get going, reset the seed bank and really thrive in this sort of area.
Bush Heritage Australia has reserves all over the country, but there are plants in this particular patch that are not found in any other part of the world. It's hard to believe, but this property has three times the plant diversity of Australia's tropical rainforests. The reserve's unusual positioning has resulted in a melting pot of species.
There are definitely good changes happening here. The overall impression we get from our monitoring, and we're about to really crunch a whole heap of data, 7 or so years worth, that should give us a really clear picture of where we're at. The interim results we've got so far are really looking really good though. Yep.
The sun's going down next to us and we're crouched beside a salt lake.
Yeah, so we've got a massive area of samphire that extends all the way out almost to the centre of the lake. Right in the centre of the lake is bare, just basically salt out there. So as you come towards the edge of the lake, you come into country where there's more blue bush and salt bushes, things that are a lot more palatable for things like sheep and goats, which is what this property used to be managed for. So obviously we now manage for conservation. We will protect all of these things, and we're starting to see, you know, a lot of these things come back and recover and regenerate. So this is one of the blue bushes, and it's as it matures, the fruits on it, the sort of papery part around the fruit is changing to this beautiful reddy copper colour.
Simply leaving the landscape alone and quietly observing the creatures in it has led the scientists to discover all sorts of interesting things in Mother Nature's classroom.
What we found a few years ago, studying these salt lakes, looking at the type of spiders that lived right on the salt itself and how they changed across the lake bed and changed again when they got up into the sand and the vegetation around the edge. And what we found on the lake bed was fascinating, in that we have spiders, big wolf spiders, that live out there and nowhere else, and they're quite large for a spider, and they have holes in the lake bed themselves. And we were fascinated, thinking, how do they survive when there's water across the lake? And so we came out at night and had a look using torches on our head, and we found quite a few of the spiders, and they perch up on the water. So they're standing up on the water for looking for prey, I guess. And what they do then, and I'm not quite sure how they did it, but they gather a bubble of air under their legs and then they take it down their burrow with them. So it helps them stay alive under the water during the daytime because these spiders are nocturnal. And then in the morning, they just pop back out again. At night, they just pop back out again and sit up on the water and looking for their prey. So it was just totally fascinating. Sometimes you can look at these sort of areas and right where I'm standing now, the bush is fairly low. But when you start getting down into detail, it's just totally fascinating. And we're discovering new things about this type of lake all the time. Yeah.
Ecologist Angela Sanders joined us to get up at the crack of dawn to check the traps left open overnight. Dr. Matt Appleby explains how pitfall traps work.
An animal comes up to the pit line, so it's like a long line of mesh that sits on the ground, right down to ground level. It's about 40, 50 metres long with pitfalls, so a bucket basically, dug into the ground every, say, 10 metres. So an animal comes to the line and goes, okay, I can't go through this barrier, I'm going to turn left or right. So it walks along that barrier and then it drops in, just falls in literally into the bucket. They just don't realise there's not normally any holes that big in this sort of country, so they're unexpected and they just fall into it. And we come along in the morning and empty the traps and collect them up and re-release them straight away, so they're not too stressed. They're only in there for a shorter period of time as we can manage.
So let's go and check out this trap here to see if there's any unsuspecting animals. Any luck? Anything in there?
We've got the Diplodactylus pulcher, which is the most common gecko species we've got here. They're quite cool. This individual here in this woodland site has a darker pattern on it than the other ones that we found in the shrubland. And that's the pattern that we've observed during our trapping this week.
And there's a big spider in there too. Have they been friends in there overnight in the trap?
Oh, I think they're, yeah, probably friends. It's a multicultural community in here. There's a centipede here as well. During the week, we actually found a brown snake in one of the traps, which was beheaded by a dunnart that was in there, which is a carnivorous marsupial, so I don't think they were friends.
Tim Doherty is a PhD student at Edith Cowan University. He's taking volunteers to various trapping sites on the reserve and taking note of what they find.
A western bearded dragon, looks like a sub-adult or a juvenile. So it's just a little grey dragon. It's got some spikes on the back of its head and down its back along its tail. It's a grey lizard.
And from here you'll weigh it and take some data down?
Yeah, we'll record the species and take its weight and then we'll mark it so we know that it's the same individual if we catch it again. 2.7 grams. Yeah, both adults. Do you want to mark them?
Luke Bailey is the man in charge of the land management of Charles Darwin Reserve, which involves anything from feral animal control, fire management obligations and maintaining infrastructure.
We're in an exciting part of the landscape. We're basically where the northern wheat belt meets the southern rangeland or the southern part of the Murchison. So you've got this amazing mix of southwest botanical sort of plants hitting the semi-arid shrublands, and that's what makes this block special. And also the fact that a lot of this kind of country was cleared heavily in the wheat belt, so there's not a lot of this left. So this is a great example of what the country would have looked like before it was developed for farming.
The reserve is on the cusp of two bioregions, which means the team needs to work with a variety of different landholders, north with the pastoralists, east with miners, and south with the agricultural communities.
What's really important to us on Charles Darwin Reserve is that we work with our neighbours. There's no point in our mind of having this oasis of, you know, conservation ideology if it's not shared with the farming community and the pastoral community and the mineral sector, because we all want this region to be productive, we want it to be healthy into the next 100 years, and that requires good conservation, good industry development. And I see plenty of opportunities for us to work together to develop new solutions, and not just Bush Heritage and the pastoral industry, but other organisations and other investors as well. So I really see the work that Bush Heritage does as a private conservation agency as a sort of new era, and we're only part of the picture, but yeah, I think it's exciting.
botanical artists, that's what we love. We love the detail, the accuracy. Everything's measured and counted, so they're at a scientific level. My paintings can take, I don't know, 20 to 50 hours. It takes a lot of concentration.
And there's certainly lots of that going on here today in the small town of Menindee in the far west of New South Wales. Hello, I'm Cherie McDonald, watching on quietly as a group of professional botanical artists from Melbourne peer intently through their magnifying glasses, sketching and painting in minute detail plants they've collected from the Kinchega National Park. These aren't any ordinary plants, though. They're steeped in historical significance, as they're the same plant species that were collected by the famous medical doctor and botanical collector Dr. Herman Beckler when he was travelling with the Burke and Wills expedition back in 1860. I'll let Marley Moyer from Beckler's Botanical Bounty Group explain what they're up to.
The group was inspired 4 years ago because of the Burke and Wills 150th anniversary. So we looked into Herman Beckler's role on that expedition and found out that he stayed here for about 3 months and collected specimens that he then sent back to Ferdinand von Mueller down at the Melbourne Herbarium. We discovered with my association with the Herbarium that he collected 120 plants here from the Menindee area. And over his whole time on the expedition, it was nearly 1,000 plants altogether over, you know, a couple of states.
Out of that 120 plants, how many have you found and drawn?
It's fairly slow, so it's one or two plants a year that we do. At the moment, I think we're sort of around the 30-40 mark.
Hi, I'm Margaret, and what I'm doing here is a tiny little stellagra, which has got minute little flowers. It's something that you would normally walk straight past, so making them five times.
So five times bigger than what they normally are.
Yes, so that you can see the detail, which normally, as I said, you would normally just walk straight past them and wouldn't notice it. You can't see it with the naked eye, but it's covered in a myriad of little white hairs. It's almost like a web on it.
Bending down here, having a look at the plant.
I mean, they're the flowers here.
It is making me go a little bit cross-eyed trying to focus.
It's nice to actually paint things and blow them up so that people can see and make people look what's in little plants.
Andrew Denham is a botanist for the New South Wales Office for Environment and Heritage, and he says finding some of the plants Dr. Herman Beckler collected in Menindee isn't so hard. You just need to know where to look.
Well, I've been coming out into this part of the world for the last 20-odd years. You just get to know where things grow. So some plants are fairly easy to see if you know what you're looking for. If you just come with me now, we'll have a look at one of the plants on Beckler's list. So this plant here is the white cypress pine. It's special in the area because even though it's very widespread elsewhere, it's quite rare in this area. Cypress pine probably is in decline because of changes in the climate, so that's the climate's becoming drier and the rainfall's becoming less predictable. On Kinchega, we know where most of them are, we think, and there's probably 20 or 30 individuals of this plant, but it's quite distinctive. It's a native pine.
It really does look like this should be the Australian Christmas tree.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because this particular plant had its top cut out of it one summer, just before Christmas. And luckily it survived that, and it's grown quite a bit since then. So if I just grab a bit of this branch here and crush it, you'll be able to smell that piney smell.
Oh, yeah, you can smell. It certainly does smell like the Christmas tree.
And the sap's quite strong smelling as well.
Why do you think Beckler took a sample of this one?
He probably sampled it because it was one of the larger trees in the region, and he probably wanted to capture for the Victorian government, he wanted to get a good idea of what all the country was like.
There's lots of little brown cones, small brown pods. Do they grow bigger or are they the seeds?
No, they are pods or they are cones, and those ones you can see they're all open and they've dropped their seeds. Every year it produces new cones and their seeds are dispersed by the wind and they'll just germinate as soon as there's a reasonable amount of rain.
I have to ask, many people have, you know, rock stars they might look up to or people who've done really well in their profession. In terms of the world of botany, is Beckler one of your heroes?
He was certainly a critical part of the Burke and Wills expedition, and I've come to appreciate his work because he did work very hard and he persisted here in the Menindee area after he'd already resigned from the group. He's not a hero, but he is certainly somebody I have great respect for.
Andrew Denham, a botanist with the New South Wales Office of Environment and Heritage, showing Cherie McDonald around the Kinchega National Park near Menindi. Still to come, getting the ovals pitch perfect for the cricket season and a beauty contest for horses.
It's like a model competition, I suppose. The horses have to look good, be very well behaved and be able to show off in the ring and do a set workout. The judge gives you a workout to do and you have to execute that workout. So it's a combined thing where they're good types, conformation, they work well and they look beautiful. It's like a model on the catwalk. They create a picture.
Welcome to the world of the Hack Competition, basically a beauty contest for horses. Hello, I'm Wendy Collis in the Horse Pavilion at the Royal Adelaide Show, where the hairspray and scissors are getting a good workout as the horses are primped and preened, ready for the keen eye of the judges. Vicky Laurie and her team have got four horses at Adelaide this year. It's taken months to get the horses this far, and the job's not over yet. Today, she's busy getting Simon ready for the judging ring.
There is a lot. We bring our horses in the 1st of May, Simon, and we start, because in the middle of winter they've got quite a lot of hair on them, so we rug them and start to feed them warmer feed and work them, and you get their skin back so it's really fine. And then when it gets close to the show, you start to show them a little bit at the country agricultural shows, which is the lifeline, really, of our shows, because if you don't go to agricultural shows, you don't qualify, and they have to be qualified to come to a royal show. You clip them all up. We clip their ears, their muzzles, their noses. They wear makeup.
When you say you clip the ears, you clip the hair inside the ears, is that right?
It's naturally got long sort of hair in their ears. We clip it back so it's fine and put oil in their ears so it looks cosmetically good. And we do around their eyes and their muzzle. We clip the hair off around, put makeup on and oil so they look good.
It just begs the question, what type of makeup do you put on a horse?
Well, it's produced, it used to be just powder wax and baby oil years and years ago, but companies have now got onto it and they all produce, there's different brands and they produce like a base makeup and an oil, and the oil actually, oil-based makeup makes it shiny and look good. Then you have what we call a coat shine. You spray them, it enhances the shine of their coat. And we paint their feet with a black thing, so their feet are black and shiny. So there's a little, and you shape their tails so they look really good. You plait their manes to enhance them. Yeah, it's like a, and you know, then you use a coloured brow band that would match your tie or whatever, and that sort of thing.
Do you have any secrets when it comes to the grooming and the preparation for Hack?
No, you just have to be consistent. A lot of people start the last week, but you've got to start. You've got to be really consistent for months. It's a lot. You go without a lot to do it, a lot of time, because they're really time-consuming. And you do have to. And you have your pitfalls with them. They hurt themselves and, you know, they injure themselves, so then you've got to get that right. Then we treat them, like, for dehydration and multivitamins and all that. So just like an athlete, really.
Shout out competitors. We're going to have our first draw to the practice fence, and yes, the book is going to be...
Simon's come to the show and he loves it. A lot of the thoroughbreds they've raced and they don't like it, but he loves it.
And I think that's an announcement. A competition's just about to start, so just as a last couple of questions, what's been the finishing touch that you've added to Simon's preparation?
Nothing really, because he's a naturally lovely coloured horse. There's nothing really. Sort of just, you've got to find natural things and you try to keep them as natural as possible with enhancement. So, no, Simon's pretty good. Yeah, we've got a lot of hopes for him and hope he goes well.
And is it true that some people use, like, false tail extensions or hairspray on the horse?
Yes, it is, certainly is. We do use false tails. I would say 80% of horses have false tails, and their companies produce them as well. They're a commercially produced thing. And all that sort of thing, so it makes their tails look fuller. We like the tails cut off square, and so you put a false tail so it thickens the hair. It's like women using hair extensions or whatever, it's the same thing.
But on a horse.
Yeah, on a horse.
Oh, I played a lot of cricket, so, cricket clubs had to find someone, and I was prepared to do it. Well, as it turns out, I'm still doing it, and that's probably over 30, 40 years ago.
The footy jerseys have been washed and packed away for another season. Now it's time for the cricket whites to make their appearance on ovals across the country. G'day, Brett Worthington with you at Mildura in northwest Victoria, where Brian Waitman and his trusty diesel roller are back in action for another cricket season. It's been a quick turnaround for this veteran curator, who's had just a couple of weeks to prepare the pitch.
Well, there is a fair bit involved, I suppose, and the thing is, after footy season, you know, the fair bit of use on the oval, obviously they bounce the ball on the cricket pitch, so once the footy season finished, you've got to get round and try and patch it up, clean the square up for a start. We fertilise it and put top dress it and then whack a bit of water in it. That's basically for a start anyway. Yeah, so we've only had 2 or 3 weeks to get it ready. And so, you know, everyone's pulled in and got it going.
So you, at one stage, were looking after 4 ovals at the same time. How did cricket pitches vary between different ovals?
That's a good question, because like this one here on 3, you can give it a certain amount of water and it retains its moisture. And but the one over the river, for instance, that used to, well, I don't know how much water camels drink, but they drink a lot. But they used to have to put a fair bit of water in to get it, you know, get it up for where you want it. Everyone's got their own ideas how you do the pitch, but I like a little bit of moisture in it when you start your rolling. It'll bring the moisture up and put a crust on the top of the wicket for you. No power of steering in it, Brett.
What exactly are we looking at here?
It's an old roller that was built in England. I think it's back in the 1930s. It's not the one that you see at the Adelaide Oval or on the MCG. Yeah, but anyway, it just does its job.
I would say it looks like a big golf cart from a distance.
Well, it would look like secondary of the Victorian Country Cricket League, they came up for a championship and he called it Freddie Flintstone's car. It was the same. It looks the same as the Freddie drives around in. So it's called Freddie Flintstone. Oh, he went all right last year, so hopefully he goes okay this year.
So what's kept you doing it for such a long time?
Oh, I suppose it's a bit of a challenge, you know, because the blokes that play on the Saturday, if they don't get a good cricket pitch, they'll tell you all about it. So it gives you a bit of motivation to try and do the right thing.
So do you ever get accused of preparing the pitch more for a batter than a bowler, or get criticised for anything like that?
Well, you'll always get someone that doesn't agree with it, but if you try and keep it pretty basic, you're going okay. Yeah, well, it's pretty interesting. I was good friends with Les Burdett over in Adelaide, and when he was over in the Adelaide Oval, I went out there, if you remember, quite some years ago, they couldn't get a test result. And they had this African couch grass on the square, and it wouldn't break up, you see, and of course they'd play 5 games and the spinners couldn't get in and out of it. So one year I went over and Les said, "Have a look at me pitch." He said, "I've ripped it all up," and he said, "I've put couch in it." He said, and after that, they start getting a few results, and he was very pleased.
It's a bit unfair when the curator's starting to be criticised for the result, isn't it?
Oh, he was devastated. But he said, "I can't get a result. The bloody pitch won't break up." You know, that was his explanation.
Now you've got your trusty sidekick Margaret here helping you out. Is there anyone else coming through that is looking to get involved with preparing pitches?
Well, Margaret's my mowing lady. She likes getting out of the morning doing the mowing, but. No, look, it's pretty. It's one of those things. I think most of the boys around the place, we need. There's no one really come up, young fellas anyway, that come up with any motivation to want to take the job on. But you never know. We always keep trying and have our ears open.
And just lastly, what does the future hold for you as the curator here?
Oh, well, I don't know how many years I've got left. I've been going for a while. I'm in my 80s now, but I'm still fit and able to get on the old girl to roll it. So, yeah, I don't know. I'll just keep plodding away until time tells me I've had enough. Yeah.
Veteran curator Brian Waitman keeping those cricket pitches in Mildura in tip-top condition. Brett Worthington, our reporter. And if you want to see what his Fred Flintstone roller looks like, check it out on our website, abc.net.au/rural.